The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
I'm in last week's lecture by Professor Dresshaus. How much you understand of her lecture? It's a lot of information. If you understand 50% of what she's talking, then I'm happy. Basically, it's I look at her notes from a fundamental point of view. She mentioned the electronic energy states in carbon nanotubes and the photon energy states in carbon nanotubes. And I do not expect that you can do the calculation, but if you caught the main idea, why nanotubes are special as a quantum system, and some of those energy diagrams didn't surprise you, then that's where I expect my expectation is. On the exam, Arvind had finished the grading. I took a look of what you did. I think I'm pretty happy about the results. There's a spread, but I can see at least for more than half of those small problems, the first part of the question that I want you to master, and I think a majority of you got it right. There seems to be two problems that there are more mistakes. One is on the tunneling results. Maybe you didn't put down the exponential decay, so you don't know what's the ratio. You see, I ask you to take the ratio, and it's really just the ratio of two exponential. And so if you didn't write down, you'll get stuck on that. But the point is, if you look at the... I said some of those order of magnitude. What's the... if you don't have any notes there, how would you think about what's the exponential decay factor there, right? So you should know that the wave vector inside is 2m e minus u, or u minus e, h bar squared. That's the wave vector inside. So wave vector times x exponential, that will be the factor determining the exponential decay of your wave function inside here. And that's the tunneling. You have a factor in the front times this exponential that gives you the tunneling probability through the barrier. So if you take the ratio of the two, you can get the what's the between 1 angstrom and 100 angstrom. And the other question I saw some of you got stuck is on this high temperature specific heat issue. Given crystal, I asked specifically, what's the high temperature specific heat? And by asking high temperature, it implies you should look for the equipartition theorem. And the equipartition says that each harmonic term in the energy, harmonic term in energy contribute on average at a high temperature. The average contribute on average. The average happens at a high temperature limit will contribute 1/2 kBT to the total energy. So if you have crystal, each atom vibration, you have the potential energy and kinetic energy, right? And you can write down this expression. You find out the kinetic energy. You have three directions, so that's 2/3 kBT. And potential energy, you also have three terms. and that will give you another 2/3 of kBT. So you sum up all this energy for each atom, you sum up all the lumber density, because given what's given is the, I think, a lattice constant, and you'll find out how much energy per unit volume. That's the specific heat. So I saw some of you went back to do all the derivation for the specific heat, starting from density of states and got the integral. And that's a mathematical expression, but when we want to have the high temperature limit, you can do it quickly. Okay. What other questions you might have? Average, I have to wait until Alvin to tell me, because when we look at it, he hadn't tell it. I would guess it's probably between, say, around 75, my guess, okay, to 85. That's the range. Okay. Now we come back to what I had been talking 1 week ago. I had not quite finished chapter 5 yet. If you recall, the idea we're talking about transport is I started with 2 points. I say in chapter 5, my way of looking at transport is from point 1 to point 2, how much of this either energy or momentum goes from point 1 to point 2. And to calculate that how much goes from this point to the other point, what I need is the velocity at point 1. And times, for example, if I look at the energy of the particle, so this is the energy of each particle, and then I know the distribution function. Assume here what's going in the forward direction, the distribution function, I took this equilibrium distribution, okay? And then I say from point 1 to point 2, what's the transmissivity? And we spend most of the chapter 5 in calculating this transmissivity from point 1 to point 2. And that could be either at a single interface where I have wave reflection and transmission. I know how to calculate transmissivity from point 1 on this side of interface to point 2 on the other side of the interface. Or it could be multi-layer structures where I calculate from point 1 and to point 2 or any other points. Okay. And in theory, even though, see, all the examples I gave in this chapter is films, simple interface, planar structure. You know from the governing equation, if you can solve the governing equation, this governing equation including Schrodinger equation, Maxwell equations, or acoustic wave equations, okay? If you know starting from governing equation, you can calculate the wave propagation from one point to the other, and thus calculate the transmissivity from one point to the other. All right? So that's the basic idea here. And then if you sum up all of the possible quantum states, at this point, so you are doing the summation, and of course when you do point 1 to point 2, you only sum those where this way is this is the x direction, way x is larger than 0, because only those component with velocity in the positive x direction can possibly go from 1 to 2, right? So that's what we have been doing in chapter 5. We spend most of time on the transmissivity. And in chapter 2 and 3, we spend time to find out what's the energy. And then chapter 4, we spend time talking about what's the equilibrium distribution. And we actually have not talked the velocity, how fast the energy carriers are going. So let me first answer this question, and then we'll continue that discussion. And this question is actually, you can see we took it for granted that if I have speed of light, electromagnetic propagation, it's the speed of light, right? And but even this speed of light, once you get into media, become more questionable. And remember, all the analysis I have been doing is based on plane wave. I have plane electromagnetic wave, a plane electron wave, and I write down that plane wave in the form of I omega t minus kx times x. If this is a wave propagation in the x direction, so this is my wave vector kx in the x direction, and maybe I can have amplitude. If it's electromagnetic wave, it's a vector. Electric field, magnetic field, that's the amplitude. If it's an electron wave, it's a scalar, right? And I think I discussed before, if I look at this exponential factor, that's the phase, right? This is the phase of the, let's say, phase is omega t minus kx times x. That's the phase of the wave. And the constant phase means when the phase, if I look at a wave, and this phase, this is the phase of the point, and this is also the same phase, that's the constant phase. The constant phase, what's the speed of that constant phase plane? So this is the phase. If it's a constant, I can find the speed is dx dt, that will be omega divided by k, right? So that's the, in this case, is kx. So this is will be constant phase. Let me just don't write the symbol. This is a constant phase in the x direction, the velocity of phase propagation, right? But this velocity is not the energy velocity. That's not what the energy or signal is propagating at. The reason to think about this, is this a signal? A plane wave is a signal. What's your judgment? Well, I can play harmonics here. I can play, let's suppose, I can play a harmonic wave here. Right? Would that be this exponential, this harmonic form? Just one single wave function here? Why not? Why or why not? Well, it is not because you look at this function here. Where is the start? Where is the end? This function here means time goes back to infinite and goes forward to infinite. It's extending in both directions to infinite, right? When I talk about the signal, I send out the signal. I have a start, I have an ending, right? Or even just if I have a starting point. So it's not going back to minus infinite. It starts from somewhere. So even if I sit here and send out a harmonic signal here, that this signal is at a specific frequency omega, right? Angular frequency omega. But it does not start from minus infinite. It starts from a time, let's say time t equals 0, and let's say the signal lasts for a time period of t, total time. That's the real signal, right? And now, if I have a real signal lasting between 0 to t, and I want to express into plane wave, I want to express into a wave that extends from minus infinite to plus infinite, what I do? I do Fourier transform. Right? If you're an electrical engineer, you deal with this all the time. You do Fourier transform of signal, you express into different frequency. Even though the specific signal I generate seems to be at a specific frequency, but because it's a finite time, when I do Fourier transform, I will get many terms. Right? Remember, when you do a Fourier transform of an arbitrary function over from 0 to t, you get an infinite number of terms. Right? And each of this term will have a, so if you do this Fourier transform, you'll get something like an psi 2 pi t n times t and plus a cosine term. Right? This n has many terms from 0 to infinite. That's your do your Fourier transform of a function between 0 and t. Okay, so what you do is, if you do your Fourier transform, you actually find out, even though this is from 0 to t, and it's a purely harmonic signal at the frequency omega, but when you express it into a function that goes from minus infinite time to plus infinite time, as what we do here, there, in that plane wave, I actually have many different frequencies. The central frequency is at omega. And then I got a harmonics. And this spacing will be 2 pi over t. That's the time span of the signal. Okay. So this, even though it's a finite, it's a purely sine function, but because it's a finite overlasting the signal, I said the way I talk is only finite, certain finite of time. What it implies in this signal I send out, it's not a really plane wave that goes in time-wise from minus infinite to plus infinite. I actually have many different frequencies. And so what happened is each frequency will propagate at a different phase velocity. Remember, if you look at the electron and photon dispersion, so this is the electron. Let's just look at conduction band. So this is the energy. Energy equals h bar omega, and this is the wave vector. So if I got different, if I have different frequency in this signal, I will have different wave vector, different phase velocity. Those phase velocity are not equal because phase velocity is just omega divided by k. It's not a linear curve. It's not equal at each point. Right? So the same thing, if you think about the photon, this is a wave vector, and this is a frequency. It's not a linear curve. The phase velocity at different frequency will be different. Right? So once your signal is generated, those different frequency components will be propagating at a different phase velocity. And now, at the end, my receiver will receive those different frequency components. And then say, let me just take two frequencies as an example. I say I have two frequencies of this plane wave. This is exponential minus I omega minus delta omega. That's smaller than the central frequency. So if I look at this point, for example, t minus k minus delta k x. I drop the subscript, the x, so that and save some writing. So this is a one component. Let me just say this is A, amplitude. The other component, I take the simple case. I take it same amplitude, but it's at a plus frequency. So these two frequencies have difference, delta kx, right? I'm just taking, for example, this point and this point. Suppose I have two waves, plane wave extending from minus to infinite to plus infinite at two different frequencies. And what at the end you can receive, you hear, your ear will hear, is the sum of these two infinite waves. So I sum them up, and what I have, then I get a 2a, and this exponential factor is minus I omega t minus kx, that's the common term. And the difference term, you do the summation, you find out that it's a cosine delta omega t times delta omega minus x delta k. Okay. Right, that's the sum of if my signal including two frequencies. These are the one frequency and corresponding wave vector, the other frequency and corresponding wave vector. And if sum these two plane waves together, that's what I get. So what does this look like? And you can see the first term is a cosine function. And this one is the original, more like the fast varying signal there. So the first fast varying signal, this will be this omega term, omega fast varying signal. And now delta omega, delta k could be small. The difference, if the frequency difference between these two signals is small, that delta omega is much slower time varying, right? Or delta wavelength, delta wave vector. So this modulation, the amplitude, that's the amplitude. This one is the phase factor there. So the amplitude will really be much slower. So much slower modulation. And these are the two. This will be your true, this is your amplitude. So it cannot exceed the amplitude, what you have here, the true signal sum that you receive will be confined inside the envelope of this amplitude envelope. So that will be the what you receive. Right? Because this amplitude is the function here. That's the same when you turn on your FM radio. The FM radio has a carrier frequency, and then that's the voice modulation of whatever people talking there. The carrier frequency is here. It's this high frequency. That's the where you tune to the say radio station, and the people talking, whatever music, is at a much slower modulation, right? So that's the same phenomenon, and so this is actually what the receiver receives, and what's the energy the receiver receives. So if this is the total signal. Electric field or wave function, remember the energy we get is always square, right? So it's E cross H complex conjugate for electromagnetic field, or it's a psi times complex conjugate delta as in the particle flux, right? So the complex conjugate will make this term disappear. Right? So one is the electric field could be here. You have this phase factor. And the magnetic field have same phase factor, but the complex conjugate, you get a plus. So the product will cancel out. So this carrier frequency is not the energy that you will be hearing. What you are hearing is actually this modulation of the signal comes in. So it is really those amplitude of this wave that represent the speed of energy propagation. Okay, what's the amplitude of this? What's the speed, constant amplitude here? So here is amplitude 1, constant. And you can see the, for the amplitude to be constant, this got to be constant. Right? So for the amplitude to be constant, what we have to have is then T delta omega minus X delta K equal constant. And that means dx dt equals delta omega delta k. And in the limit, delta omega and delta k is small, then it's dk, d omega dk. So this is the actual speed. Usually, this is the actual speed of the energy that's propagating. And for electromagnetic wave in a vacuum, you don't have any problem because this is a K, this is omega, and just a straight line. In a vacuum, the constant phase, constant amplitude, or the constant amplitude, this is a constant amplitude or group velocity there, coincide with each other. So for light in vacuum, people usually don't care about it. But once you get to Fourier, you can say d omega dk means the tangent of this. That's the velocity here. And group here, this is a zero at the zone boundary. Here is a maximum. Right? There's a big difference if we talk about group velocity for this highly dispersive mid when the is no longer a linear dispersion relation. So this velocity of constant amplitude is called group velocity. And this clearly is only moving in the x direction. So in the most general case, the group velocity Vg is really d omega dkx. That's the velocity in the kx direction, so unit vector, d omega dky. KY unit vector direction, and d omega dkz, kz unit vector. Or could be written as subscript vector omega. So that's the velocity that typically, say, the energy is propagating. And I use the word typically that the energy is propagating. Because you can see here, what I'm assuming is that this delta omega and delta k change much slower than omega and the k change. Right? Right? But if this one changes very fast, then I can no longer make the same claim. That's the because otherwise this term will not just cancels out when I do take the average and say this constant amplitude will be my constant energy plan. So this group velocity, this is the group velocity, is usually the energy velocity. But not always. And for example, if you look at the optical constants, refractive index of a medium, and turns out that there are frequency range region where you got the refractive index change rapidly. So this will be refractive index n. And this is the as a function of wave vector, wavelength. Okay, refractive index is a concept for electromagnetic wave, right? So if you recall, the speed of light in a medium is the speed of light in vacuum divided by refractive index. Right? And but this is the phase velocity. And when this one change, n is a function of v vector or n, because n v vector can be converted into frequency c0 n omega. And you find out if you go to do the group velocity in this rapidly changing region, you can get the group velocity also larger than the speed of light, which is against the relativity. But in that case, this group velocity is not what the actual energy is propagating at. So although in most of cases we can think about group velocity as the energy propagation velocity, but that claim is not always valid. And if you go back a few years ago, there are headlines, people are talking, say people are measuring some sort of velocity higher than the speed of light. Okay, the media will offensively say, does that mean Einstein is wrong? No, it doesn't mean the people doing real work knows that doesn't mean that Einstein is wrong. It's just because in this case, so you here you generate some signal, okay, going through a medium, and turns out that there could be some small thing that in the front, most of the signal is still in the back, and they detect the small thing in the front, and that's faster than the speed of light, and then you would say the translation is, does that mean you violate the relativity? Okay, but the true answer is most of the energy signal is still in the back, and you don't violate the relativity. And group velocity is a concept that has been really a lot of people started it. Hamiltonian, starting from Hamiltonian to Rayleigh to Brillouin, all those people started group velocity. And then in reality, there are also, I think, the Brillouin zone we talked about. And his PhD thesis was on this topic. And there are several velocity defined. Group velocity, signal velocity, phase velocity. So it's the signal velocity that represents truly how fast a signal going from one place to the other. And most of the time, they equal to the group velocity. But in cases we are discussing in this highly dispersive region, you can have the group velocity much higher than the speed of light. So that's what we should use. So coming back to my story here, now you know what to use in this velocity. And you should use the group velocity, not the phase velocity. Okay? And the group velocity is by taking the gradient of the dispersion curve. So if you have Folon here, you can see at the zone boundary, this dispersion curve always is perpendicular to the zone boundary. And perpendicular to zone boundary means the group velocity is zero. And this is zero group velocity created some density of states. So there are some sharp fissure in density of states. That's called the Van't Hoff singularity. And if you look at the electron as an example, electron here, E equals EC plus H squared K squared 2M, right? And if you just use your phase velocity, let's say VP equals omega divided by K, or let's just take a KX in the x direction, you see you will not get the user form expression. Let me do a little bit more operation to show you. Let's take a EC equals 0. Then VP equals h bar squared kx squared divided by kx 2m. So what you have is h bar kx 2m. And h bar kx is the momentum in the x direction, 2m. Velocity classically, we know the velocity is related to momentum by p divided by m. But there you got the effect of 2 more, right? Less. This is a phase velocity. You go to check the group velocity, v group equals d omega dk, that is h bar de dk, then you get just h bar kx in the x direction, and that's m. This is a px divided by m. That's the conventional definition, consistent with our picture here. Momentum is related to velocity by mv, right? So that's an example. And now, so those are the discussion for chapter 5. And when I presented this picture of transport, I say going from point 1 to point 2, I calculate what we need to calculate transmissivity. And when we calculate transmissivity, I did not consider possibility that the, for example, a photon or electron inside the media will scatter with other photon electrons. We just say this is a plane wave propagating, will get scattered, and we didn't say it will collide with the other photon or electron, right? And so all this calculation is really treating the transport as a wave problem, and as a wave that does not experience inelastic scattering. Okay, with so I have an electron wave comes in, and say you could have lattice vibration in the solid that just scatter that electron. I don't know how to calculate that transmissivity. And in fact, once you get into that regime, doing this very often, you should not do this coherent wave calculation. We should go to more dealing the transport as a particle transport problem. And I want to spend another 20 minutes now talking about this really wave to particle transition. Now that's a very tricky regime because there's not very good description. Okay, in terms of how in reality a lot of complicated things can happen. So I just want you have sit there and be able to have a feeling on it, because in reality, even now I write proposals, so we sometimes write how we're going to treat this regime, transport. Okay, it's just not very apparent tools very easy tools to deal with this. So let me start with how we're going, when we can forget about the phase of this energy carriers. Because here we are solving wave equation, and we maintain all the phase information, right? And if you look at the way we solve electromagnetic equation, the phase part is part of the solution. When we can just forget about this phase, okay, when you do gas dynamics, or when you treat the solar radiation come towards this room, into this room, and then we want to do the radiation absorption transport in this room, we do not go to solve Maxwell equations. We just treat this photon as balls coming toward this room, particles coming to this room, and on this wall they will be bounced to other wall. And that bouncing process we make, okay, for that specific interface at this wall, we may go to this Fresnel formula to calculate reflectivity. But once it comes out, we forget about that. And see wave characteristics, because Fresnel formula is based on the wave, right? And we just forget, we say this going from there to other, I don't trace the phase, how much phase change. I just say, what's the fraction of this particle, photons, going from that place, this to the other place? So that's a particle picture there. Don't consider phase. And when we can do that, that's a big question. And one of the answer is coming back to what I was talking about, the superposition of many different waves. Right? Here I give you two example, a two-wave superposition, just a slight different frequency. And in reality, you have many different frequencies. So you do that superposition, so you do the superposition, so this topic is, let's say, loss of coherence. How I can deal with this going from coherent transport regime to incoherent. So if I do the superposition of many waves, and you'll see you will get this kind of, when you got the many wave superimposed together, you only have a small tail in the surrounding. And this signal is really propagating as a pocket of energy. Okay? That spread out to a certain region here. And this is the wave packet. Okay, so here I'm giving you this wave packet that's extending through the whole space. But you got a lot of frequency superimposed. So you generate it. At this instant, I see a word. And that energy is focused into that specific voice, word there. It's propagating as a wave packet. It's not extending very far in space. Right? So that's the signal is extending over a small region over the space only. And this is the length of this wave packet. And let's say, you can think of this length as here, as a coherence length. And this coherence length, approximately, we can estimate how wide it is. But this is the velocity of the wave propagating, and this is the spread of the frequency. Okay? Spread of the frequency. And here is the, you can see this is the spread here from delta omega to plus delta omega. That's a spread of frequency. Right? So lasers, you can think about laser. Laser have speed of light and spread in frequency narrow spread. Right? Very narrow spectral line. You get a very long coherence length. It can be a kilometer long. Right? And but black body radiation or the electrons, photons are much shorter. We can go to estimate. I give you only order magnitude for thermal source. Thermal source right? What's the spread of energy in thermal source? Again, I'm hand waving, okay? It's not exact. At high temperature limit, the energy is a kT, right? I say the energy spread is also kT. So I would just say the energy spread is of the order of kBT, and that means delta nu is kBT divided by h, divided by h. Right? So with that, I say this is my coherence length due to the thermal spreading, because the thermal means I got a lot of wavelengths of different thermal wavelengths, different wavelengths. Because inside, either black body radiation that contains different wavelengths photons, or inside a solid, it contains different wavelengths of photons or electrons. And so with that, I say velocity times h divided by kBT. So this is roughly the order of magnitude, the length of the wave packet due to thermal excitation. And how large is this? So you go to take example. You take a photon that's a speed of light 3.10 to the eighth, h 6.6, 10 to the minus 34. And Kb 1.38 10 to the minus 23, 300 Kelvin. Right? So how much is that? 10 to the minus 23, that gives me 10 to the minus 11. Plus 8 gives 10 to the minus 3. So that this 2, 0, 10 to the minus 3 gives me 10 to the minus 5. 3, 1.36. So this is about what? 3 cancel. It's about 3, 10 to the minus 6 fifths. Right? It's of the order of the peak of black body radiation. Peak of black body radiation, does anybody remember where it happens? Okay, so yeah, that's the Planck's law. 2898 micrometer Kelvin, so I 300 Kelvin is about 10 micron. There I threw you about number 30 micron, or, right? But the idea is comparable to the peak of the black body radiation. Now you can do the same thing. You go to do electrons, and that will be giving you a number between 1,000 to 100 to 1,000 angstrom. And you go to do photons, this will give you 1 to 10 angstrom because the speed is much smaller. Okay. So now I look at this wave packet. It comes towards the interface. I said the solar energy comes towards the interface here. And we may still have to go to use the Fresnel law to calculate reflectivity. Why? Because here I got an interface, and I have this wave packet comes in. Okay, see, solar is a wave black body radiation. It emits certain wave packet of radiation come in. Okay, so you can think about the atoms there just going from upper energy level to lower energy level and give up one signal, a photon signal. Okay, that photon signal come in as a wave packet and towards the surface here, and you can see the reflection here. I got a half of this wave packet still coming in, but the other half already goes out, right? And you can see they have fixed relation. This is the same wave packet. They have fixed phase relationship. So you should go back to use the wave expression. You use the Fresnel law to calculate reflectivity. You got a lot of very rough interface that becomes more troublesome. You can see, right? Unless you can trace, if you got a very rough interface, unless you can, okay, at each point if you can trace it, you can still think about the wave calculation. But the average speaking, you don't know. Now, I look at a different situation. I get a film, right? So I get a film, and this wave packet comes in, and some of this will be reflected, and some will be refracted. So refracted is a smaller amplitude. Maybe it will be modified, the shape of the wave packet will be modified by the refractive index. And then this one will be reflected again. Okay, so this wave packet could be reflected here. Right? Just think about the spatial extent of the wave packet compared to the thickness. Now, if the thickness is very large compared to wave packet, what happens? The chance of this wave packet overlapping with the same wave packet is very small. Right? Now your next wave packet can come in. That's from the source. Next wave packet can may overlap with the other wave packet. But that overlapping is random. Because the next wave packet, the timing comes is random. It's the emission source at a different time. You can't control that. It's a random emission source. Right? So in that case, you can just trace this wave packet as one packet that don't have the interference effects. Just go and bounce like a ball back and forth. Some is a little cloud. So that's a clear case that you can use the particle description to treat this wave. And of course, when the film is very thin, then you can say if your wave packet is much wider than the film thickness. So here is still some of the wave packet even not going all the way through the film. The other is the same wave packet reflected. And this different wave packet that have the same from the same source, same wave packet just split, right? And thus, when you treat this case, you have to use the wave description. Because the phase is all interrelated to each other. So when your film is very small, you use the, compared to this coherence lens, you use the wave description. And this is a typical terminology what people do in optics. Optics, photons, they talk about this in the context of optical coherence theory. And but that's not all the story, because this is actually, we wrote a recent paper, but it's if you work in different fields, there are some phenomena that people understand very well in other fields, not in specific field that you work on. So one of this example is that's my impression. I always say, if the regime you're dealing with is much larger than the coherence lens, if the geometrical regime, then you are safe to use the wave the particle description. Just forget about the phase. But that's not quite right. Okay, I thought about that. I believed that for a long time until I look at this problem, which people have looked at in other fields, as I said. So if I look at periodic structure, this is a 1, this is 2, this is a 1, this is a 2. And I make this period very thick, much thicker than the coherence lens. So if I have black body radiation come in, I can calculate transmissivity, reflectivity, I integrate each frequency, that's the wave results I get. I can also do the billabong. I do trajectory of these photons, don't consider phase, which I haven't taught you how to do it, but I can do that. And my expectation is when the film is very thick, I can use the billabong model, right? That's not right. It turns out that we went to check it, not quite right. Because I first did Folon, and then I did the photon. Folon I did several years ago. And we recently did the photon. It's not right because think this is a wave packet that comes in. And now, inside, if it's only one layer, there's no chance it will overlap. Because when this is a thick, it's just to say it doesn't have real chance to overlap. The problem is when I have periodic multi-layers, you can say this is this is the original one. Some of this will come here and then reflect it back. And each interface will give me some of the original one. And if I make this right, summation right, there is a chance that the, let's say if this is a very thin, so there could be chance that some of those in one layer will overlap with the same wave packet that's reflected from other layers. You sit there, you think about it, that's what the mechanism. So we actually did this calculation, and that's originally I put it as a homework problem. Okay, this is one of the cases. I said there are lots of problems in, at least in this book, you can write papers. And at the end, first of all, my students work on this. I said, why don't you do a real calculation and see whether that's the case. And it's indeed in this case, if you do your wave calculation, and it will never agree with the particle treatment. Just forget about the face treatment, which we'll discuss in the next chapter. And this is a periodic structure. That's just like a photonic crystal Bragg reflector. That's the case I'm indicating. And then the other case is if I make this periodic structure slightly random, okay, I saw that, well, by that I may get the wave, the particle, because the random thickness means I can cancel the waves. And turns out that cancellation does not exactly lead to the particle picture either. And that cancellation needs to, if I calculate reflective transmissivity from the whole structure, okay, this is as a function of layer thickness or increased number of layers. And transmissivity from the wave would go, if it's an ideal picture, is going this way. It just doesn't feel. You add more interface, still have the same transmissivity because the waves are extended, block waves. And then if you do the particle picture, it just keeps dropping. Every layer you add, there's a reflection there. And then when we did this random, let me make this thickness slightly random, I can get a different curve. I can even get a lower than this curve. And what happens is, in that case, the wave create a destructive interference and create this so-called localization phenomena. I just want to give you the name. Don't feel frustrated because this is a regime that there's not really very good tools to deal with. Okay, their Nobel Prize given. Localization was given Nobel Prize to Anderson Mode in the 50s or 60s. Okay, they studied this localization for electrons transport. And what happened is the wave comes in, it just because the interference effect just cancels it. The cancellation created a wave that, say, eliminated the existence of some of the waves. So it just does not propagate at all. So this is another regime. And all of this happens for the case where I don't have any really phase randomizer. I mean, when I have reflection, when the wave goes through this layer, I don't see I have an electron or I have a photon to scatter the photon. It's the elastic propagation regime. There's no real energy. The energy of the wave doesn't change. So in the field of optics, people talk about coherence. And that coherence often have a different meaning when you go to talk to physicists, electrical engineer. They'll talk a different coherence. And this coherence, so here I say if you deal with an elastic wave, you can have the optical coherence length, localization phenomena. But once you go to crystal, because we said the wavelength or the coherence length is very short. You can see electron photons, very short, tens of angstroms. And in that case, what do you have? You have other photons comes in. If you think about electron wave packet propagating, okay? And the electron propagate, they will collide with other photons or other electrons in the system. The photon appearance of the photon is random in time phase, right? So this scattering, the collision process is very random. When it happens is very random. It's not like I have a stationary surface here. That's always there. Always, every time it hits there, it experiences scattering. Here, I got a random center to scatter it. So if a wave packet comes in and it scatters, okay, it will go to the other direction. But I have many those random scattering events. So if in that case, if your regime is much larger than this inelastic scattering mean free path. Here is the mean free path, but it is inelastic, means the scattering changes the energy. Because when an electron scatters with a photon, they change the energy, they change. And because the time of that collision is random, you can see that's randomized that phase. The phase is no longer fixed because at this instant is one value, the next instant is different value. And you don't know where it happens. Right? So that's a phase randomization, and this inelastic scatter is what electrical engineer or physicist typically mean but when they talk about discuss coherence effects, coherence process. Okay? So the coherence lens is typically in inelastic mean free path for this. And this is fundamentally destroying the phase, inelastic scattering. And the elastic scattering, as we see here, surface roughness, or those are just a superposition of different frequencies of waves. So really, in this region, if you have your structure much larger than the inelastic coherence lens, you can just forget about this wave packet and just treat this electron as the particles, the balls inside. So the electron gas, photon gas, that's the first chapter we said, you got a gas there. But so far we've been talking about electron wave, photon wave, but how to go from this wave to gas? The gas means I don't care about the phase. Waves means I have to care about the phase. Okay? So that's there. This is the transition. And this transition region, it's very hard to predict. It's very hard to model. You can, there's people trying to do various experiments to understand the phenomenon. But in terms of what you actually encounter in the system you're going to deal with, it's complicated. Yes, you have a question.
For a distribution that maybe is not completely random, maybe has, let's say, velocity component in one direction, small one or something.
For a distribution of, you mean the frequency? Or what? What distribution? Or the scattering center?
Right, right. Say the scattering is just slightly disposed, not to be random.
Yeah. So there's not a good answer to your question. Exactly. See, I'm writing proposal today. See, for what we want to deal with. If you think about, I have a nanowire. I want to look at the wave propagation in this nanowire. I got the interface roughness there. The interface roughness is not a dynamic scattering center. It's just there. So it's an elastic scattering center. But most of the time, people will just treat this regime as either a quantum regime or a particle regime. But you can actually also have localization. There are also some papers studying the localization. But when you actually deal with the material, what you should do, which region you are in, it's hard to say. Okay, there's no real, very simple criteria because a lot of time you don't even know the structure you're dealing with, the detailed structure interface. But there are just those possibilities, different possibilities. And that's why I say this is a regime, lots of questions, okay? And most of the time, for example, if I do just this multi-layer optical wave example, I said that when I wear the thickness, I found out that I just couldn't get the retracing limit. But very often, it's not thickness variation. This glass, maybe the surface roughness variation, or the two not a parallel surface. And those are more become a three-dimensional problem. And it's known in localization study that three-dimensional is harder to localize waves. So if you don't have that localization, you got this you have wave comes in that scatter in all directions. And this scatter, superposition of the scattering, at the end, the result could be very similar to the results where you just treat this as an idea structure, but treat it as a rough interface, diffuse interface. Just forget about the wave. And it could be more accurate, at least when we do Fourier transport, because the Fourier have very short wavelengths. And I found that most of the time, I just assume rough interface is much better than you assume perfect interface and go to solve the wave equations. Okay, this is by comparing with experiment. Okay. So it's more than what I want to spend, but it's a very complicated regime. Yes?
In the case of Fourier.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is the, you say, that the material size is smaller than the past, then we have to consider the wave effect. Right?
Well, yes. Well, okay. Well, here I say this is the complication, okay. Here I say when the inelastic mean free path, when the structure is smaller than inelastic mean free path, you may run into the wave regime. But to have the size effect, you almost always have to have the structure smaller than the mean free path. Otherwise you don't have size effects. So when you always in silicon, for example, the Fourier scatter, that number again is very fudging, but I give you 3,000 angstrom. That's the inelastic mean free path. So if I deal with only a film of 100 angstrom or 200 angstrom or a wire of the same diameter, that mean free path is this long inelastic scatter. That means the waves will scatter at the interface. And this scattering is more an elastic scattering. It's not like a random, because the point here, I got a bump here. That always is there. Always have that scattering. So the question is whether this scattering really do you need to consider the wave effects when you deal with that scattering? And my personal experience is most of the time I don't for Fourier. I just treat this as a particle because this, my explanation is that this is a random in location, the location doesn't change, but a superposition of this random scatter wave lead to the end result similar to the case where you just don't consider phase. That's where I go to particle treatment. But I'm not very confident in saying that because the intermediate regime, not many study there. Not many experiment, not many study. Right? So, yes?
So far we have treated photons and electrons separately.
Yeah.
Is there some way they can combine and show collective behavior, like some kind of coupling between electrons and...
Electrons and photons, that's the next chapter, the coupling. Well, you bring me to the what I want to do. So let's forget about this. Complicated. But depends. If you have to deal with this, messy. This is a region very messy, okay? But doesn't mean it's not fruitful. And like I said, Nobel Prize was given to this topic of localization. And now I'm assuming that I can neglect the phase. I assume that you already agree there are some, the lots of transport regime that I can neglect the phase. I just treat this as particles. And the chapter 6 to chapter 8 all deal with the particle regime, transport regime. And that's, so we'll discuss the chapter 6 particle description. Of transport process. And the first thing now, I have to, when I deal with transport, I deal with long equilibrium. And how to deal with long equilibrium in the particle regime. So I will first introduce two equations, Novo equation, and then Boltzmann equation. And the transport that we'll be dealing with is really based on Boltzmann equation. And many times people just think Boltzmann equation is everything. But it's not. In fact, if I give you the Lovell equation, you'll see a Boltzmann equation is a huge simplification. Based on the Lovell equation. So what's the idea of a Lovell equation? If you remember that in chapter 4, when we discussed the equilibrium system, it's very simple because for equilibrium, I can use one single distribution function that with a very small number of variables. So for every quantum state that has energy E and with a chemical potential and the temperature, I have either Bose-Einstein distribution or Fermi-Dirac. That's the for equilibrium system. Like I said, when I deal with transport, I'm dealing with a non-equilibrium system. And I cannot use this simple equilibrium distribution to describe the probability or the average Lambert density of one quantum state. So what do? Well, I can go to the most cumbersome way to think about it. I say, well, I look at the ensemble. And remember in chapter 4, we discussed the concept of ensemble. So what an ensemble means is just I look at the system rather than look at concept that we use rather than look at the time history. We look at the all possible quantum system of the symbol, of the system, or all possible quantum states. So if I have a system of n particles, this system has n particles. Okay. The Lovell equation, let me just comment. I don't want you master. I just want you hear about it. Okay? But I want to give you this concept. So I have n particle system. And an ensemble is I have quantum state 1 of this particle, this system. And I have many other quantum states, the same number of particles. This is quantum state 2. And I build up each of the quantum state is one system in my ensemble. Now, for this n particle, I take an arbitrary particle. This, let's say, particle I, right? And this particle has location and momentum coordinates. And if I know every particle location coordinates, my problem is solved. Right? That's a microscopic point of view. If I know every particle's location and momentum in the whole system, I know everything. So this particle I, it has location coordinate, and it has a momentum coordinate. And of course, I can generalize this location coordinate. If the particle is a molecule, diatomic molecule, this location not just space, but angle, rotation of angle. That's also the location to specify the molecule. So this R can be very general. It could be XYZ, Cartesian points, where it is, and theta phi, the angular direction, the orientation of the. And then for each of this location, there is a corresponding momentum, angular momentum, translational momentum. So I have generalized location, generalized momentum. And if each of this has an m component, right? If you just consider translation m equals 3, if you consider rotation theta 5, right? And similarly, this one correspondingly also has m component. That means then if I have two n particles, the variable I have is then 2mn. Those are the variables I need to describe the system. Of course, that n, capital N, is huge. So this just take an Avogadro constant. That's the number of variables you have. And now I plot a curve. I say I establish a coordinate for this many variables. So that's a multivariable coordinate, which I cannot draw, of course. I can only draw two. So I draw this one is a general. I put this one because here is a vector, and I do this 2mn variable. So one of this is R space. The other is pi. And each of this I goes from, is 1 to mn. So I have 2mn variables. So this is pi and ri. And that means each of, because this is including every particle coordinate momentum, so every point here is just a one ensemble. One state in the ensemble, right? Quantum state 1. I know all the r, all the p in quantum state 1. I know quantum state 2, that could be another point. And the whole ensemble then is just a number of points in this generalized coordinate. And the dimensionality of this coordinate is 2mn coordinate variables. And this is my phase space. Okay? And then I define the density, particle density, which is the system density, right? Because each point represent one system in the ensemble. Particle density as my n particle distribution function. So this will be my n particle distribution function as a function of time, space, momentum, generalized space, generalized the momentum. That's my variable. And if we times the volume, which is Ri delta Pi, that's the volume of the phase space. And this gives me the number of systems. Either Ri, Pi, and in this small volume, how many number of systems? So this is really like I define the density of a medium. Right? That's my n particle distribution function. Except that now I got, you see, this is a huge number of variables, remember here. I'm just writing 2. And now the Liouville equation is just to govern the time evolution of this n particle distribution function. And let me give you the reason. The point behind this Liouville equation is because it's microscopically, if you have an initial condition for a system, the time evolution of the system is determined. If you just think about the Newtonian mechanics, right? So that means for different quantum, because each quantum state is a different state. If it's a different initial condition, they will never overlap with each other. Because the time variation, history will never overlap. Otherwise, they reverse the time, they'll come back to the same quantum state. So that's the basic foundation for deriving the Liouville equation. And with that foundation, let me not go into the detail. I just want to write down the Liouville equation. And the Liouville equation is Fn time plus sigma I equals 1 to n r, the time derivative of the ith coordinate, and dfn dr I plus sigma I equals 1 to n, and the momentum coordinate, time derivative of momentum coordinate, dfn dp I, and this equal to 0. So this is the Lovell equation. Okay, and the one of the reasons I want to mention the Lovell equation, you can say it's really, okay, this number small n is m times n. That's the number of variables you have. So it's a huge number of variables. Okay, if you can solve this equation, you know just for every point, every momentum, what's the number of states, density of the quantum states in the ensemble. And of course, most of the time we can't solve it. Except when you go to do molecular dynamics, and you can trace the every particle velocity, every particle position. So from the Lovell equation, this is really the master equation for classical transport. There are two directions to go. That's the one is to simplify Boltzmann equation. The other is the linear response theory. So if you want to do molecular dynamics, you should be familiar with this direction. Boltzmann equation is different from, it's a two different assumption, two different simplification. One is to reduce the variables. The other is in using small perturbation theory to solve the equation. So two different approach. And this is chapter 10 I'm not going to cover. I'm going to spend the next 2 weeks to cover the Boltzmann equation approach. Okay? So with that, I hope Arvind was able to come. What time is it? 25? He said that he's going to come, but I think I'll just stop here. And he has graded the exam.